Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and an online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense. We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com for comprehensive show notes, infographics, fast and furious wallpaper, or to just leave comments. Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Do you have any people paid by the CIA who are working for television networks?
This, I think, gets into the kind of getting into the details, Mr. Chairman, that I'd like to get into in executive session.
We are in a period where conspiracy theory is flourishing.
There has been an explosion of conspiracy theories.
Conspiracy theorists are having a field day.
It's like Christmas for conspiracy theorists.
Countless conspiracy theories.
It feels like there's more of this out there than there has been.
Why are there so many of these people?
Conspiracy theories are a great American pastime. And not all of them are on the right. There's plenty on the left as well.
They could be from the far left. They could be from the far right. They could have unconventional, deranged theories.
They had very much gone down the kind of rabbit hole of conspiracy thinking, all kinds of ideas, the world is not as it seems, and so on. That's a very American preoccupation.
Conspiracy theories are not new.
Conspiracy theories have been woven into the fabric of American society since before the signing of the Constitution.
A lot of these conspiracy theories have a presence, or at least a grudging acceptance, within the political mainstream.
It's out there. It's become part of pop culture now.
I see the pretty mainstream conservative media really flirting with these folks and maybe starting to mainstream some of this craziness, so we maybe won't be able to ignore it.
Wingnuts, how the lunatic fringe is hijacking America.
The fringe has become the center. The Republican chairman of Homeland Security is writing conspiracy theory letters, and they're convening conspiracy theory hearings, and Republicans senators are introducing conspiracy theory legislation.
You have politicians who are, repeating conspiracy theories, who are advocating conspiracy theories.
The most influential conservative media online is full on embracing the conspiracy theorists.
Every conspiracy theory are all coming together, and they've created this narrative, but it's all out of their talk radio base. It's all out of their right wing online base, and they've now converged on Congress, and they've pulled them into the conspiracy theorizing too. It's brilliant.
Reality has been subsumed into a conspiracy theory.
There has never been a conspiracy in this country.
Do you ever encounter people on certain forums, message boards, or conversation threads online that are unabashedly pro-US? Now, I'm sure you're thinking, yes, of course, why would that be strange? There are a lot of people out there supportive of the US government engaging in conversations in the social media world. But I don't mean those people. I mean the online personas that, oddly enough, are unrelenting in their patriotic vitriol and troll for literally hours trying to debunk legitimate questions or any opposition to the establishment. Sometimes, it almost seems like these people might even be getting paid to do it. I mean, how else could they expel that insane amount of time and energy on these comment threads trying to argue how wrong you are? Well, this might be old news to some, but last year it was confirmed that the U.S. military has been manipulating social media by using fake identities to influence conversations and spread pro-American propaganda. It's called Online Persona Management Services. And under the CENTCOM contract, it allows the creation of up to 10 sock puppet accounts for every U.S. serviceman or woman working on the program. The stipulations are that every fake persona must have a convincing background, history, and supporting friend networks so that it will remain undetectable from even the most sophisticated adversaries. According to The Guardian, the project has been likened by web experts to China's attempts to control and restrict free speech on the internet, and that critics are saying that it allows the U.S. military to create a false consensus in online conversations, crowd out unwelcome opinions, and smother commentaries or reports that do not correspond with its own objectives. Now, of course, according to CENTCOM, their only objective is to counter violent extremists and enemy propaganda outside of the U.S., and that it would be unlawful to address U.S. audiences with the technology. Wow, unlawful, really? Interesting. Because the newest version of the 2013 NDAA included an interesting amendment. This amendment legalized domestic propaganda on the American public. You heard me right. The newest NDAA wasn't just reauthorizing the indefinite detention of American citizens. It also allowed the U.S. government to legally carry out misinformation campaigns against the citizens of this country. But is this really surprising to anyone? I mean, the corporate media is basically a propaganda arm of the U.S. government anyways, isn't it? Why the need to legalize the use of propaganda when you already have an entire mainstream media establishment lacking to the White House, reprinting government press releases without question, selling wars, and carrying water for the administration? In fact, aside from everything I just mentioned, the Pentagon already spends $4 billion a year to influence public opinion, and the Department of Defense also spends hundreds of millions of dollars on information campaigns in countless countries occupied by the U.S. military. But perhaps even more disturbing than all of this is the fact that the CIA has already been infiltrating the biggest press institutions since the early 1950s. One has to look no further than Operation Mockingbird, a secret CIA campaign to spread disinformation and false stories to foreign governments during the Cold War. It did this by manipulating the media into focusing on propaganda, sabotage, and subversion. It was later revealed in congressional hearings that the CIA program consisted of literally paying off editors and reporters at most mainstream news outlets. The New York Times, CBS, Time, The Washington Post, Newsweek, AP, Reuters, and countless more. In one instance, a journalist named Joseph Alsop, who's alleged to have been one of the most prominent journalists working under Operation Mockingbird, wrote foreign affairs articles that appeared in over 300 publications. So, isn't it nice to know that the supposed watchdogs of the government can be so easily bought? Even though the intent of this program was to focus on matters outside of this country, it undoubtedly influenced everyone living here at the time. People to this day could still be reading and referencing these articles, not knowing that they're completely fake. And sure, this is more than 50 years ago, but let's face the facts here. Our media is much worse now and has been much more easily compromised now. So how do we know that Operation Mockingbird still isn't in effect? Well, we don't.
As soon as there was television, there was Operation Mockingbird, set up by Frank Wisner, the CIA's Office of Special Projects Director, perhaps as early as 1948. The influence of foreign media was one of many functions of this covert action branch, which, by the early 1950s, according to Deborah Davis, the author of Catherine the Great, Catherine Graham, and Her Washington Post Empire, wielded serious influence over the likes of the New York Times, CBS, Newsweek, and many smaller communications outlets. Roughly 20 years later, and just 1 year after New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison began an investigation into the assassination of John F. Kennedy, the CIA circulated internal document 1035-960, titled Concerning Criticism of the Warren Report. Part 1. Our Concern. From the day of President Kennedy's assassination on, there has been speculation about the responsibility for his murder, although this was stemmed for a time by the Warren Commission report, which appeared at the end of September 1964. Various writers now had time to scan the commission's published report and documents for new pretexts for questioning. And there has been a new wave of books and articles criticizing the commission's findings. In most cases, the critics have speculated as to the existence of some kind of conspiracy, and often they have implied that the commission itself was involved. Presumably, as a result of the increasing challenge to the Warren Commission's report, a public opinion poll recently indicated that 46% of the American public did not think that Oswald acted alone. while more than half of those polled thought the commission had left some questions unresolved. Doubtless polls abroad would show similar, or possibly more, adverse results. Number 2. This trend of opinion is a matter of concern to the U.S. government, including our organization. The members of the Warren Commission were naturally chosen for their integrity, experience, and prominence. They represented both major parties, and they and their staff were deliberately drawn from all sections of the country. Just because of the standing of the commissioners, efforts to impugn their rectitude and wisdom tend to cast doubt on the whole leadership of American society. Moreover, there seems to be an increasing tendency to hint that President Johnson himself, as the one person who might be said to have benefited, was in some way responsible for the assassination. Innuendo of such seriousness affects not only the individual concerned, but also the whole reputation of the American government. Our organization itself is directly involved. Among other facts, we contributed information to the investigation. Conspiracy theories have frequently thrown suspicion on our organization. For example, by falsely alleging that Lee Harvey Oswald worked for us. The aim of this dispatch is to provide material countering and discrediting the claims of the conspiracy theorists, so as to inhibit the circulation of such claims in other countries. Background information is supplied in a classified section and in a number of unclassified attachments. 3. Action. We do not recommend that discussion of the assassination question be initiated where it is not already taking place. Where discussion is active, addressees are requested, and I'm adding this, to do the following list of things. A. To discuss the publicity problem with, and something is blacked out right there, and friendly elite contacts, especially politicians and editors, pointing out that the Warren Commission has made as thorough an investigation as humanly possible, that the charges of the critics are without serious foundation, and that further speculative discussion only plays into the hands of the opposition. Point out also that parts of the conspiracy talk appear to be deliberately generated by communist propagandists. Urge them to use their influence to discourage unfounded and irresponsible speculation. B. To employ propaganda assets to negate and refute the attacks of the critics. Book reviews and feature articles are particularly appropriate for this purpose. The unclassified attachments to this guidance should provide useful background material for passing to assets. Our ploy should point out, as applicable, that the critics are, 1. Wedded to theories adopted before the evidence was in, 2. Politically interested, 3. Financially interested, 4. Hasty and inaccurate in their research, or 5. Infatuated with their own theories. In the course of discussions of the whole phenomenon of criticism, a useful strategy may be to single out Epstein's theory for attack, using the attached Fletcher, and something is blacked out right there, and Spectator piece for background, although Mark Lane's book is much less convincing than Epstein's and comes off badly where confronted by knowledgeable critics. It is also much more difficult to answer as a whole, as one becomes lost in a morass of unrelated details. Part 4. In private, to media discussions not directed at any particular writer, or in attacking publications which may be yet forthcoming, the following arguments should be useful. A. No new significant evidence has emerged which the commission did not consider. The assassination is sometimes compared with the Dreyfus case. However, unlike that case, the attack on the Warren Commission has produced no new evidence. No new culprits have been convincingly identified, and there is no agreement among the critics. Parenthetically, a better parallel, though an imperfect one, might be with the Reichstag fire of 1933, which some competent historians now believe was set by van der Lubbe on his own initiative, without acting for either Nazis or communists. The Nazis tried to pin the blame on the communists, but the latter have been more successful in convincing the world that the Nazis were to blame. And this is a reference to Marius van der Lubbe, a mentally ill Dutchman who some have claimed was brought to the scene of the crime by Nazi agents. B. Critics usually overvalue particular items and ignore others. They tend to place more emphasis on the recollections of individual witnesses, which are less reliable and more divergent, and hence offer more handholds for criticism, and less on ballistics, autopsy, and photographic evidence. A close examination of the commission's records will usually show that the conflicting eyewitness accounts are quoted out of context or were discarded by the commission for good and sufficient reason. C. Conspiracy on the large scale often suggested would be impossible to conceal in the United States, especially since informants could expect to receive large royalties, etc. Note that Robert Kennedy, Attorney General at the time, and John F. Kennedy's brother, would be the last man to overlook or conceal any conspiracy. As one reviewer pointed out, Congressman Gerald R. Ford would hardly have held his tongue for the sake of the Democratic administration, and Senator Russell would have every political interest in exposing any misdeeds on the part of Chief Justice Warren. A conspirator, moreover, would hardly choose a location for a shooting where so much depended on conditions beyond his control, the route, the speed of the cars, the moving target, and the risk that the assassin would be discovered. A group of wealthy conspirators could have arranged much more secure conditions. D. Critics have often been enticed by a form of intellectual pride. They light on some theory and fall in love with it. They also scoff at the commission because it did not always answer every question with a flat decision one way or the other. Actually, the makeup of the commission and its staff was an excellent safeguard against overcommitment to any one theory, or against the illicit transformation of probabilities into certainties. E. Oswald would not have been any sensible person's choice for a co-conspirator. He was a, quote, loner, unquote, mixed up of questionable reliability and an unknown quantity to any professional intelligence service. F. As to charges that the Warren Commission's report was a rush job, it emerged 3 months after the deadline originally set. But to the degree that the commission tried to speed up its reporting, this was largely due to the pressure of irresponsible speculation already appearing, in some cases, coming from the same critics who, refusing to admit their own errors, are now putting out new criticisms. G. Such vague accusations as that, quote, more than 10 people have died mysteriously, unquote, can always be explained in some natural way. For example, the individuals concerned have, for the most part, died of natural causes. The commission staff questioned 418 witnesses. Parenthetically, the FBI interviewed far more people, conducting 25,000 interviews and re-interviews, end parentheses. And in such a large group, a certain number of deaths are to be expected. Parenthetically again, when Penn Jones, one of the originators of the 10 mysterious deaths line, appeared on television, it emerged that two of the deaths on his list were from heart attacks, one from cancer, one was from a head-on collision on a bridge, and one occurred when a driver drifted into a bridge abutment, end parentheses. Part 5. Where possible, counter-speculation by encouraging reference to the commission report itself. Open-minded foreign readers should still be impressed by the care, thoroughness, objectivity, and speed with which the commission worked. Reviewers of other books might be encouraged to add their account to the idea that, checking back with the report itself, they found it far superior to the work of its critics. Footnote, and I'm adding this, the 10 mysterious deaths mentioned in that document was the CIA's way of describing 30 deaths connected to the Kennedy assassination, not all mysterious. And once the Garrison investigation commenced, more names were added to the list. February 1967, Harold Russell, who saw the escape of the man who supposedly killed the police officer Tippett in the movie theater, killed by a cop in a bar brawl. February 1967, David Ferry, an acquaintance of Oswald, a Garrison suspect, and an employee of Guy Bannister, died of a blow to the neck, ruled accidental. February 1967, Eladio Del Valle, an anti-Castro Cuban associate of David Ferry, being sought by Garrison, died of a gunshot wound, as well as an axe wound to the head. Dr. Mary Sherman, a David Ferry associate working on cancer research, died in a fire, possibly shot. The following May, Dr. Nicholas Chetta, New Orleans coroner, who reported on the death of David Ferry, heart attack. August 1968, Philip Garacci, also sought in the Garrison investigation, electrocution. January 1969, Henry DeLon, brother-in-law to coroner Chetta, murdered. January 1969, E.R. Walthers, Dallas deputy sheriff who was involved in the depository search, claimed to have found a .45 caliber slug, shot by felon. Also in winter of 1969, Charles Mentisana, who had filmed a rifle other than a Mannlicher Carcano being taken from the Dallas Book Depository, heart attack. April 1969, Mary Bledsoe, negotiator to Oswald, who also knew David Ferry, natural causes. April 1969, John Crawford, close friend to both Ruby and Wesley Frazier, who gave a ride to Oswald on the day of the assassination, died in a plane crash. July 1969, Reverend Clyde Johnson, who was scheduled to testify about a Clay Shaw-Oswald connection, fatally shot. 1970, George McGann, an underworld figure connected to Ruby, murdered. August 1970, Abraham Zapruder, who took the famous film of the JFK assassination, natural causes. December 1970, Salvatore Granello, a mobster linked to Jimmy Hoffa, Santos Trafficante, and a Castro assassination plot, murdered. 1971, James Plewman, mobster tied to mob CIA assassination plots, murdered. 1972, Hale Boggs, House Majority Leader, member of the Warren Commission, who began to publicly express doubts about its findings, disappeared on an Alaskan plane flight. In 1975, the Zapruder film was shown on TV for the first time. In September of the following year, the United States House of Representatives voted 280-65 to establish the Select Committee on Assassinations to further investigate the assassinations of President John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr. Hearings began in 1977, at which time the list of mysterious deaths began to grow in a rather accelerated fashion. January 1977, William Pauley, former Brazilian ambassador connected to anti-Castro Cubans and organized crime figures, gunshot ruled suicide. March 1977, George de Morenshield, a close friend of Oswald and a CIA contract agent, gunshot wound ruled suicide. March 1977, Carlos Prio Socarrás, former Cuban president and money man for the anti-Castro Cubans, gunshot wound ruled suicide. May 1977, Lou Staples, Dallas radio talk show host who told friends he was going to break the assassination case, gunshot to the head, ruled suicide. March 1977, Paul Regorodsky, business friend of George de Morenshield and wealthy oilman, natural causes. June 1977, Louis Nichols, former number three man in the FBI who worked on the JFK investigation, heart attack. August 1977, James Cadogan, FBI document expert who testified to the Warren Commission, cause of death, fall at home. August 1977, Joseph Ares, chief steward on JFK's Air Force One, cause of death, shooting accident. October 1977, Donald Kaler, FBI fingerprint chemist, heart attack. October 1977, J.M. English, former head of FBI Forensic Sciences Laboratory, heart attack. November 1977, William Sullivan, former number three man in the FBI, who also headed Division 5 Counterespionage and Domestic Intelligence, hunting accident. Other organized crime figures included Charles Nicoletti, died in 1977, Sam Giancana, 1977, Johnny Roselli, 1976, Leo Mokeri, 1976, all murdered. And CIA members John Paisley, suicide in 1977, John Martino, natural causes in 1977, David Morales, natural causes in 1978. Morales was 54 years old. Aside from their connections to the CIA, organized crime, anti-Castro Cubans, or the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Another commonality between all of the men I just named was, due to their deaths, they were unable to testify in front of the House committee. And footnote. So anyway, what's the point? The phrase conspiracy theory appears in the Oxford English Dictionary as the theory that an event or phenomenon occurs as a result of a conspiracy between interested parties, specifically a belief that some covert but influential agency, typically political in motivation and oppressive in its intent, is responsible for an unexplained event. The Oxford cites a 1909 article in the American Historical Review as the earliest known usage of the term, which had been, prior to CIA document 1035-960, a neutral term, but not afterwards.
Conspiracy theories are widely publicized in books, magazines, TV shows, movies, and online. Odds are, you're even a conspiracy theorist. Their profound popularity has undoubtedly attracted significant media attention. However, as you will see, the majority of the mainstream coverage concerning conspiracy theories is typically negative, incredibly biased, and disturbingly void of logical objective analysis. The conspiracy theory term is the establishment's most effective method to dismiss legitimate inquiries, control the parameters of debate, condemn the criticism of authority, deceive the public, and conceal the truth.
Are there definitions that we can lay out here? Where does somebody go from asking a legitimate question to becoming a conspiracy theorist?
The Merriam-Webster Dictionary defines a conspiracy theory as a theory that explains an event or situation as the result of a secret plan by usually powerful people or groups. A theory is an idea that is intended to explain facts or events, and conspiracy is clearly defined in criminal law as an agreement between two or more persons to commit a crime at some time in the future. Thousands of people are found guilty of conspiracy charges every year in courts around the world because conspiracy is an inevitable component of human nature and society. By definition, conspiracy theory is a neutral term. It doesn't mean anything good or bad, it just means a theory about a conspiracy. However, the media has hijacked the term and uses it in a vastly different way.
When someone in the United States says that that's a conspiracy or that's a conspiracy theory, by definition they mean it is irrational, illegitimate, and without proof.
When we talk about conspiracy theories, we tend to speak about them in a negative light because the very word conspiracy implies something negative, I think.
A conspiracy theory no longer means an event explained by a conspiracy. Instead, it now means any explanation or even a fact that the establishment does not acknowledge or recognize as true. The only real criteria for a subject to be considered as a conspiracy theory is for it to be characterized as one. Of course, not all conspiracy theories are created equal. Some conspiracy theories lack in facts and credibility, while others are unquestionably legitimate and deserve further examination. They vary widely in supporting evidence and plausibility, but each claim should stand on its own merit. Nevertheless, the media broadly paints them all with the same conspiracy theory brush, lumping them all together and dismissing them as ridiculous, baseless fantasies by merely mentioning the conspiracy theory term.
This is a conspiracy in theory and spurs of a conspiracy.
I'm sorry to kill your conspiracy theories, but that is what happened.
He's you know, putting together these conspiracy thoughts, and I'm asking you if you agree.
They use the term conspiracy theorist to essentially shut down any dissent, to really shut down any analysis of what the government is telling us.
He said the government should call anybody who stands against them a conspiracy theorist. This isn't a conspiracy theory.
Kind of an out there conspiracy theory, which does not warrant a lot of attention.
To discount something as a conspiracy theory is to shut it down without actually answering a question. It's a typical political move.
The bottom line is that this is a group that is driven by conspiracy theories about the government.
If you know anything about disinformation, if you know how governments discredit other governments and discredit movements, they always say conspiracy theory. It's the first thing you go to because people don't want to be involved with conspiracy theories in any language, in any country. They just don't want to be involved in it.
It's just this term that's become this Pavlovian conditioning technique. And once that's thrown out, we've all been trained to run away from whatever subject is being talked about. As long as you can just frame it as conspiracy theory, then you can get people to stop taking a look at it.
Outrageous, ridiculous conspiracy theories about how the world works, giving the impression that everyone's running around wearing a tinfoil hat.
I was called a conspiracy theorist in the mainstream media, and I know you've been called one too, and I think it's really important to address this pejorative term.
This woman, we need to be clear, is an out-and-out lunatic. She's a conspiracy theorist.
Telling the truth is not a conspiracy right. theory. It's just such a cheap shot to shut down debate and critical thinking.
The talk show host is Alex Jones. He's a conspiracy theorist. He's kind of like the guru, the king of the conspiracy theorists. Yeah. He's considered legit among the crazies.
Alex Jones, king of the conspiracy theorists.
Conspiracy theorists, you relish the word.
The king of conspiracy, radio show host Alex Jones.
I'm not the king of conspiracy, I'm the king of reality.
Conspiracy theorist Alex Jones.
Conspiracy theorist Alex Jones.
Conspiracy theorist and conservative radio host like Alex Jones.
They just marginalize him by calling him a conspiracy theorist.
I don't know what he is, except a conspiracy theorist.
Yes. Hello, everybody. This is the School Sucks Podcast. Today is September 12, 2015. And welcome back to Conspirathon, the prequel.
Whoa!
You never know what's going to happen here, I guess. This time around, we'll be giving the subject a more serious treatment. It doesn't mean the silliness is completely over. But here's what's happening today. I'm going to be joined by Nick Ulbrich, a listener from Australia. He's here to discuss his research on what he calls conspiracy narratives in contemporary culture. By the way, some of that opening montage came from a film called The Conspiracy Theory Conspiracy. We'll discuss it briefly in the show, and you can get a link to the full film in the show notes at schoolsucksproject.com. I'm very excited to welcome, for the first time as a guest, Nick Ulbrich. Hi, Nick.
Hey, hot dog.
So I say as a guest because people have definitely heard your voice on the show before. You called in when we did the live show back in the day. Your morning, because you're in Australia, it was our late night. And you're also the star of one of my favorite School Sucks videos that probably not too many people in the audience have seen. You were briefly a part of a musical ensemble called the 13 Time Zones Quartet. We did an a cappella performance spanning 13 time zones on Skype. You were in Australia, Daryl Becker was in Hawaii, and Richard Grove and I were in Hartford, Connecticut. And I thought that was the most fun. So welcome to the show. It's great to have you here.
Oh, thank you very much. It's absolutely my pleasure.
So let's talk a little bit about you, because when you called into the show in the past, we never really got into your background. I know you did mention to me that when you saw our setup, our studio, it was a bad experience for you, the boomerang table?
No.
It was positive what? Experience, the seeing that we had a boomerang table. Boomerangs.
Why would that be a bad experience?
I don't know. Boomerangs are big in Australia. And
No, it depends. They come in all shapes and sizes.
Yeah.
What happened into my boomerang story, when I was young, we have this day camp, which is just a glorified excursion called Ceres. Basically, you do a range of things to learn about, you know, Indigenous culture. But one of the things we were taught to do was make boomerangs from some Indigenous teachers. So we had to, like, cut them out, and then we were taught to throw them, and we got to paint them with, like, the Indigenous markings and all this. And when I got home the first day, my dad took me for a walk along the beach, and I was, like, really excited and showing off, and I was like, watch me throw this boomerang, it'll come straight back, because that's, you know, the idea of a boomerang.
Right.
So I threw it directly. Now, we were down the beach, mind you. I threw it directly into the sea. Never saw it again.
That's a sad story.
Oh, no, because, you know, what comes from the earth returns to the earth. And now, look, the boomerang has gone from being a wooden tool to being a big wooden tool that we're now using to communicate. So
yes,
there you go.
That's a nice way to look at it.
So it's really, it did come back to me. It just took 20 years.
I like your attitude. And we're continuing here, Conspirathon, as people will know by the title of this show. But you, I think, are especially qualified to talk about this topic from some interesting new angles. I wanted to get into what your background is that, in my opinion, qualifies you for some of the topics we're going to explore today. But let's start even further back. You are from Australia. I would say a majority of my audience is American. So Australia mm-hmm. is exciting to us. What can you tell us about where you live, where you grew up, Nick?
I live in a Bayside suburb. Funnily enough, it's called Bayside, a 15-20 minute walk from the beach, which is awesome. I live in a suburb called Hyatt. So not Hyatt like the hotel chain, but Hyatt, as in the English robber baron who stole the land.
Sure, yeah.
Despite the massive gentrification over the past 10 or 12 years, Hyatt is still the poor cousin of Sandringham, which is our wealthy seaside suburb. It was always safe, but there was always an element of jeopardy growing up in Hyatt, you know. I like to sort of say that we grew up in the ghetto. But I got to say something. It wasn't until this year, and actually watching Shameless, I don't know if you know that show, that I actually found out what a ghetto was. Because as my girlfriend Meg loves to joke now, for many years, because did you ever see that film about the Rothbard, the black and white film from the 30s?
About the Rothschilds?
Yeah, the Rothschilds.
I have listened to a good portion of it in an episode of Peace Revolution podcast.
Oh, okay. You should go back and watch it because, like, just the actual acting, and it's a really good film. Basically, they live in, like, these streets that are sealed off.
So these are just like the Jewish ghettos. Yeah.
But basically, they're like an alley. So there's, like, one street, and it's locked at either side. So my whole life until this year, I grew up thinking a ghetto was an alley. So Meg is always going on about, like, whenever we pass an alley when we're walking around the city or whatever, she's like, look, Nick, it's a ghetto. if you're really unkind and you actually understand the definition of ghetto, you could describe Hyde as a ghetto. But so, you know, in the 1950s, Melbourne hosted the Olympic Games.
Mm-hmm.
So about or maybe 2 miles from where I live, there's the Olympic Villages, and they were turned into commission housing, so low-cost housing for people who needed emergency living situations. But in one of those commission flats, there is an ice epidemic. It's really, really bad. I've sometimes taught at a university setting, and, you know, you occasionally get young students because I'm young, I'm only 28. So occasionally students will come up and kind of want your advice about life. And one of the things they'll ask is like, oh, what's your sort of thing on drugs? You know, we hear that marijuana is legal in the States. Is it safe? You have to understand what you're doing is what I say to them. Never just do something because you think it's cool. Always have a good understanding of what you're doing. And stay the fuck away from ice. Can I say fuck on this show?
Yes, you can. What is ice? I don't know. I've heard that term before. I don't know if it's extremely popular here. Do you know about it?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. It's basically crack cocaine version of meth.
A crack cocaine version of meth?
Yeah.
I thought meth was the meth of meth. You know, like coke is a little bit cleaner and crack is a little bit dirtier. But meth just starts out really dirty. That sounds really, really bad. And just to return to the tracks here, Nick, that was a story about who you were and where you came from.
Yeah, returning to the tracks. So my nickname of this year is the Transcendental Tangent General.
This is who you are now. It's quite a name.
Yeah. Well, one of my really close friends who I make films with labeled me that, the TTG. So I would describe myself as a generalist. So I don't really have any very specific field that I've spent my life really studying. I did film and English in my undergrad. I did film in my honors. And then for my master's, I've done behavioral science. But my interests range from everything from sociology, psychoanalysis, classic literature, philosophy is a big one. So social theory, French social theory in particular, Durkheim, Foucault, Bourdieu, Badiou, Guattari, and Deleuze. But yeah, I've been a listener to your show since 2010, and I often in my mind call you Bert Vinette because I find that more funny than Brett Vinette.
Yep.
But for my master's, I studied conspiracy narratives and contemporary society, which is probably why you've asked me to come on Conspirathon.
Absolutely.
And much of my work has been using qualitative research methods and focusing on interviewing people in and around Melbourne who engage or disengage, which is really important because some of the people I spoke to actively disengaged with conspiracy narratives, but I don't think we can necessarily exclude them from the conversation.
Absolutely. Before we even get into that, Nick, I had something I wanted to ask you. How did you did this world of the conspiracy theory first open up to you? Like, what was your first experience? What was your first exposure? How did that translate into this deeper interest that ultimately led to pursuing it in a master's program?
That's a really good question. So it actually happened when I was writing my honors thesis. I was doing a analysis of the Coen brothers of war. Mm-hmm. And one of their films is called Raising Arizona. And in the opening montage, Nicolas Cage says something like, "I tried to do right and fly straight, but it was difficult with that son of a bitch Reagan in the White House." Now, on the surface, that's just a throwaway line, but the context and the connotation of that is massive. And that really opened up for me a whole understanding of political history through popular culture, which is what I was writing my thesis on. Because as you're aware, the Coen brothers sort of sit outside Hollywood, but they're not really truly independent artists. They've got this their own brand, a little bit like Quentin Tarantino in that respect, where
exactly.
They do work with Hollywood. Obviously, Nicolas Cage is a big Hollywood actor, so they do work with Hollywood, but they're not Hollywood. And so they have this kind of outside looking in perspective. So when they sort of broach political history, they have the freedom, in one sense, artistically, to be able to comment where perhaps a more conservative studio wouldn't. And so that opened up a whole world. And I ended up seeing this BBC documentary called Operation Able, I want to say Archer. So Able Danger was the 9/11 one?
Yep.
So Able Archer. Now, this is where we got fucking close to nuclear annihilation. Well, so Russia was extremely paranoid during the Cold War, and they had people, spies for the KGB, who would literally go into buildings and count how many lights were left on. And if you remember back in the 80s, the Kremlin was old. They were aging. Gorbachev and that were coming to the end of their lives and getting very paranoid. And America, with Operation Able Archer, were doing a training exercise. The cliff notes is that they were doing a drill where they were reacting to a threat of nuclear warfare from Russia, where it was like Russia's flick the switch.
Right.
The Russians weren't let in on the fact that this was a drill. So they were like, what the fuck? America are reacting. What's going on? So they thought, we better prepare. One thing led to another, escalation, miscommunication, and the Russians had one key turned and were about to turn the other key, and the guy was too nervous to turn it. And in that moment, they were able to avert and abort the mission and realize that this wasn't real. This was a drill.
Wow.
Then I was like, holy shit, there is some things going on in the world that are just not what I expected. And at that point, Richard Grove had his documentary just come out. I watched that and then the rest just sort of followed from there. And so my interest in alternative media was fostered through your work and the work of James Corbett, Tragedy and Hope, a few other podcasts as well.
So it's relatively recent then?
Yeah, probably 5 years.
And I wanted to get into detail about the actual work you did.
For my master's. So when I went in, so what happened in 2008, we had the mortgage crisis, as you Americans like to call it, but what the rest of the world calls the global financial crisis. Because I'm not sure if you're aware, but if Wall Street sneezes, the rest of the world gets a cold. That's the sort of famous adage.
Yep.
Yeah, shit really hit the fan in 2008. And I was finishing my undergrad. So I'm like, yeah, no, I'm not going to get a job. I'll stay in uni for a few more years. And I had a really great lecturer who became my supervisor on this. He wanted me to continue in behavioral studies, which I'd taken as an elective, but I didn't have enough credit points to do it as an honors. So he said, go away, do your honors. And then once you've done that, you'll have the academic freedom to do any degree you want, and we can do it as a master's. Fast forward a few years, and I'm sitting down with him and I'm saying, well, what if we do an analysis of the macroeconomic emergence between Wall Street's release and the famous Gordon Gekko line, greed is good, and Wall Street 2, Money Never Sleeps, looking at the savings and loan crisis through to the global financial crisis.
Right.
And so we started working on that project. As I was working away, looking into sociological, political aspects of the global financial crisis, and I just said to him one day, I'm like, no matter which way you go with this, it always comes back to a conspiracy theory. And I said to him, so what is the university's policy on, say, 9/11? What do we take this? And he's like, yeah, well, you know, the university as an institution just accepts what the official story is. Mm-hmm. And I sort of looked a bit forlorn. And I said, well, what if we just assume that the conspiracy theories are true because I can't move on? And he stopped me and goes, that's brilliant. That's how we'll start your thesis. I'm like, oh, I don't want to do a thesis on conspiracy theories. And
what was your reluctance there?
Because they're conspiracy theories. It's so nebulous. It's like, how do you even begin? Like, you can't prove it. I had two supervisors, and my other supervisor said, look, if you're going to try and prove conspiracy theories in your thing, I'm out.
Right.
So we had to just massage it. That was the whole thing, because it's so non-normative as a topic, and I'm doing a master's degree, which is one of the most normative things you can do. So that was where the reluctance was, not against conspiracy theories at all. Like, they're integral to our society in many ways, and have been for, you know, well, since the founding of America.
Yep.
And obviously way back, you know, you think about The Art of War or, The Prince by Machiavelli.
History is often conspiracy, for sure.
Yeah, so that was where the reluctance came, but it didn't last, and I got into it, and I think the other reluctance was that if you're doing a master's thesis, you have to do a big literature review. So my thesis was by research, it wasn't by coursework, so I didn't have classes or anything. I just went to the library and read and researched and wrote a book, and eventually I went and... Well, the book is the thesis, obviously, but in doing that, I went and actually did field work. So I went and interviewed participants for the thesis, and that was my data. And that's why it's called Conspiracy Narratives in Contemporary Society. So looking at the way that Melburnians engage and interact with conspiracy theories. And again, that comes back to why I put an emphasis on engagement and disengagement.
So you're focused on this one fairly narrow group of people, which you said to me before. And I thought what would be really interesting here is to start getting into what was reported to you, or the stories or the thoughts or opinions or fears that were shared in these interviews. That could prompt me to talk about what some of my experiences have been here, to see if we can come to any conclusions. And you said that most of these interviews were centered around two questions, right?
Four.
Four.
Yeah, I was sitting around four, but I want to ask you
sure.
two from my thesis. So I guess the first question, Brett, if I can put on my researcher hat and you can put on your participant hat.
Yep.
Brett, first of all, what would be your pseudonym? Because I can't use your actual name.
Steve.
Steve, what in your opinion is a conspiracy theory?
And you want me to answer the question honestly, even
yeah,
though my name
yeah,
is Steve?
No, yeah.
All right. I would say that a conspiracy theory is essentially an accusation two or more people were plotting something in secret. Usually it needs to be done in secret, because even though it has a great benefit for the plotters or the conspirators, it affects other people negatively, or other people would become resistant or even forcefully opposed to it if they knew about it.
Yeah. See, that's a very different answer to the ones that I got.
Okay, tell me some of the, from memory, what did you get back when you asked that question?
Well, not from memory. I have my thesis up.
Oh, perfect. So great.
So I'm just going to read you what I actually found.
Okay.
Yeah, just as a flavor. So one of my participants was named Mr. Walker, and Mr. Walker said that a conspiracy theory would be any information that is withheld or changed to cover up information going out to the general public. Michelle said that there are powerful groups out there, whether they're the government or other, and that these groups include secret societies that know the truth of what's going on. Jim said that the true meaning, or a conspiracy theory, is the true meaning of the true act that is being kept secret from the wider populace.
The true meaning of a true act?
or a truther.
Or a truther. Okay. Okay.
And also, but Jim also outlined in his opinion that the term conspiracy theory has derogatory connotations when used in general conversation.
Yes.
Jason suggested that conspiracy theories serve as a topic of discussion, and he was incredulous towards them and said that they have little political consequence. But he argued that conspiracy theory is purely a theory made up of certain events and coincidental elements to produce a story for a given situation. But he went further to say that at the end of the day, you don't really know the whole truth to the story.
Okay.
Benjamin said they're an allegory for people trying to find an explanation for why things happened.
Oh, interesting.
And he went further to say that in the 20th century, there have been a number of major events that are called conspiracy theories. And he said the moon landing was one of them, and whether or not the American government was behind the shooting of JFK. But he was very focused on the narrative function. So he also argued that it was the public consciousness trying to explain the unexplainable or trying to make an unthinkable event into something possible. And Alex had a really interesting answer. So he said that conspiracy theories are actually a form of discourse to create a social space, which is academic jargon, but basically the conspiracy theories are a type of story, that they're very malleable. And so in being a story, they actually create virtual and physical spaces. So this right now, Brett, our conversation is a virtual space that has actually been created through conspiracy theory.
And there's, of course, much larger spaces, too. If I'm understanding that concept correctly, could we call the 9/11 truth movement a social space created by a conspiracy theory?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I would argue that, yeah. But Alex went on to argue that the stories are very mobile. They can occupy various spaces and they can actually morph and transpose, become other things, get translated. He said that the nature of a conspiracy theory, the reason why he'd use a story approach, is that it's actually a kind of architecture that allows you to plug in people and play actors in. So the story itself of basically all conspiracy theories is suggesting is a very familiar one. You know, there's this person did this thing, bad things happened. But the actual nature of the actions and the nature of the actors can change.
I'm just trying to understand that. What do you think an example of that would be?
Historically, we could take the American Revolution and the French Revolution.
Okay.
And say that they're very similar architectures in what caused them, or what was the flint that sparked the fire.
Yeah.
And then they were morphed and transposed based on the actual people involved. So King Louis and King George are different kings, have different connotations. France is a semi-landlocked country. America is a series of colonies at that time. But the general gist of the thing is, and you could even throw in Das Kapital by Marx as a similar story in that way. Not to say that Marxism is a story, you'll get emails about that. I'm not suggesting that. But I'm just saying in this context, it's the same architecture in a way.
So essentially there's a framework. This reminds me of the InfoWars thing. We have evidence, the U.S. government being involved in this nefarious plot because past U.S. governments or other governments around the world have also been involved in similar nefarious plots. In other words, there's a framework that has similarities from country to country or from time to time, but the people who are actually in the framework change what ultimately happens. So an example of that would be one of the things that 9/11 conspiracy theorists bring up all the time, which happened in the early 1960s, Operation Northwoods, or something that was created in the early 1960s, Operation Northwoods, but because
as a part of the attempt to overthrow Castro.
Right. So you have a framework.
I think that's too specific in terms of what I found.
Okay.
That's too specific. I would more think like the threat of the invader. So maybe during the Cold War, the threat of Russia was morphed and transposed into the threat of terrorism would be more akin to what this is talking
okay,
about.
Okay, yeah.
Or the threat of the Masons became the threat of the Catholic Church.
Gotcha. That makes sense.
Yeah. So it's not quite as specific as that. Because I think once you start to get into specifics and actually start to dissect them, there's no way that you could say that JFK and Sandy Hook are just the same story with different actors plugged in. I mean, there is certainly a lot of similarities, huge anomalies, guns, death, change in political structure, but I don't think that you could say that they're the same in terms of the actual story.
Agree.
And I think I think what's important in terms of Alex's opinion of a conspiracy theory is that these stories are meaningful, that we make meaning for ourselves and as a society through telling stories that are conspiratorial, because the stories represent elements that are integral to who we are. And importantly, what he suggested was that they expose our doubts, uncertainties, our trust and fear. And so from an academic perspective, this echoes Donna Haraway. And Donna Haraway argued that the world is ultimately a combination of the material and the semiotic, and that we use stories in order to make meaning in the world. Through this argument, what she suggests is that we're ultimately living inside stories. So everything we do is inside a story, and that there's no way outside of a story.
I understand that concept. Okay.
Yeah. And so then he goes on to talk about how you could make a close analogy between conspiracy stories and science fiction, in the sense that in a science fiction story, you have a what if moment. So Star Trek, for example, what if we had a device that we could hold in our hand that we could point out to the world and instantly get information? And that was called a tricorder. And isn't it interesting that 30, 40 years later, we have iPhones and smartphones?
Yes.
I think in a similar way, we could say that the tricorder was just a prop, and that what we have today in the iPhone and the smartphone is nothing like the tricorder. But the essential ingredients of what made that what-if moment happen, when we opened up that space imaginatively, allowed us to create socially. So then we get into the argument that you say, but Nick, surely you can't just say conspiracy theories are just an imaginative space. What about Iran-Contra? You know, what about Area 51? Well, these are things that people spoke about that came true.
Well, then the language has to change. Yeah, but then the language has to change. We can't use the term conspiracy theory anymore. And that was one of the things that I was looking forward to dealing with. We don't have to deal with it right now, but it's something that we'll get to in the show. The nebulous nature of the term conspiracy theory, how that term is used. One of your interviewees already brought that up, that it's kind of a pejorative, right? And I do this all the time. I probably did this 15 times in the first Conspirathon. I either use the term conspiracy theory for something that was true, or use the term conspiracy for something that was a theory.
Look at the court system. You can be charged with being a conspirator. It's a legal definition. You're right in bringing up this distinction between the popular notion of like the term conspiracy theory, especially as someone like Rachel Maddow might use it.
Yeah, as a complete dismissal.
Right.
I just wanted to let the listeners know, and you too. I don't know what a lot of people who are interested in this, including you, would get out of it. There is a new documentary that might be a nice share with people who tend to consume more mainstream media. It's called The Conspiracy Theory Conspiracy. And
you know, I was actually just watching that before we started this interview.
What did you think of it? Because it deals with that subject, that you can dismiss anything out of the mainstream by just labeling it conspiracy theory now, which is one of the problems that we're trying to address in this ongoing series.
Yeah, and this is where vocabulary and grammar in the sense of what you've just been talking about in the Trivium series that you did with Daryl Becker. Shout out to Daryl Becker, by the way. Big fan of his work. And Tony Myers is a great thinker on these issues as well. But, you know, these things are going to move one funeral at a time, really, isn't it? What we're seeing, that famous generation gap between sort of the baby boomers and people born in the 80s and 90s, the world has changed so significantly in just the last 15 years.
Yeah.
So there's this model of the world which has been inculcated through institutions such as the school system, such as religious institutions, such as the Catholic Church, the Protestant Church, and other religions. I mean, let's not just single those two out. We can also see it in the way that when we go back over history, a wonderful example would be the 1950s. Like, we all remember it as like this Leave It to Beaver fantasy. The world was so good back in the 50s. Was it? Really? I mean, for fuck's sake, a nuclear bomb had been dropped only a few years before that.
If you were a white man and you were straight.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? If you're a white man, maybe it was good, but I don't think it was. I was speaking to my grandfather, who is just turned 90 this year, and he was talking about growing up in the 30s and before the time of washing machines. Now, my grandfather was beneath the poverty line. I mean, he didn't have shoes to go to school with for many years. But he talked about what I found interesting was the way that his mum, Alice Ulbrich, used to wash clothes. Was she'd get a big pot, boil water in a pot, and then use this big stick, like a big wooden spoon, to push the clothes down as they came up. And it's like, in some ways, the washing machine is brilliant. And I'm not saying let's get rid of washing machines. But in other ways, it's like you don't even realize the social change that happens when you go from the time that it would take to wash clothes, the care that was required, to just throwing in your clothes into a tube, pressing a few buttons and waiting 40, 45 minutes. You know, like it's such a big change. And so when we reflect on the 50s, we've got so many sudden social changes, like the advent of the consumable refrigerator, the advent, as I said, washing machine and white goods, even to a very limited extent, the advent of TV, definitely the popularity of the radio. And these are all massive social sort of structures. And then you're coming off the back of two world wars. And I think what's interesting is, like you're saying, white men, but think about the fashion of the 50s. And the classic example is the wife who is wearing the petticoat with the apron, and the husband walks in and she's got a hot meal on the table for him. Now, I'm not saying this is even the case, but imagine for a second if the reason that the women of the 50s were doing that is because some women were getting beaten. So in order to prevent the shame of that becoming immediately obvious, all women adopted this fashion that would hide it. So instead of just, you know, Sally down the road wearing a scarf around her neck to hide the bruises and a lot of makeup, Sally and Betty do it. So only Sally's being beaten, but Betty does it in solidarity so that you can't tell. And in a sense, it does normalize it, and that's problematic. But in another sense, it shows the ingenuity of culture to move at a faster rate than institutions. And I think that's what we're really seeing now, is that the cultural movement through things like this show, but also through things like the internet, through popular music and things like this, is moving a lot faster than even like the Khan Academy. The Khan Academy moves so much faster than K through 12 curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
So to get hung up on this idea of, oh, the word conspiracy theory, we need to move forward and change this word in the vocabulary, I think it's the wrong move. I think it's like fighting the Federal Reserve. We need to be more aware of our own use of it, and we also need to be more clear on what we're talking about when we say it.
Exactly.
But to answer your question, I've only seen the first 10 minutes, but from what I've seen of this film by Adam Green, yeah, definitely worth checking out.
Yeah, I think it's really good for a certain type of person. I mean, I think some people, for reasons that we can discuss, go full hook, line, and sinker into believing a lot of conspiracy theories without due diligence, while there's a polar opposite to that of people who just say, oh, that's a conspiracy theory. You know, and it was interesting that you're talking about the 1950s. While you were describing that, I'm thinking, and I've been obviously very critical of like the baby boomer generation, who were very young, little children in the 1950s, mostly, like my mm-hmm. parents. And I'm trying to understand. I mean, obviously, it's really hard to make generalizations about people who are just, you know, arbitrarily put into this generation called baby boomers. But if you start thinking about it in this cultural context, there are some generalizations that I think are fair to make. And one of them is that it does seem to produce, being born in that time, being raised in the 1950s, especially as a young child, a kind of innocence when it comes to worldview. And I've just seen this again and again and again and again in the people that I've talked to. But what you brought up makes me wonder how much of that apparent innocence is actually based on a repression, based on an unwillingness to look at certain things. You know what I mean? I had a conversation with my dad a couple weeks ago. We were at the beach, and you know, he's eating peanuts, and we're talking. And my other brother is there, my youngest brother, who has similar viewpoints. And my dad says something like, "So, Brett, you must be at least kind of enthusiastic about some of these people that the Republicans have are putting up to run for president in 2016." And I was like, "What? Who? Enthusiastic?" You know, and he's like, "Well, you know, Ted Cruz, you know, if you are saying, like, you know, you liked Ron Paul, how can you not like Ted Cruz? And how can you not like Rand Paul?" And then, you know, and he said, "And you have to admit, you know, Jeb Bush is a good candidate." And I, you know, I went off on a whole speech about the Bush family going back to Prescott. And he said something like, "You're very cynical, right?" So now he's a smart man, but having doubts or reservations or suspicions about these accepted institutions in society. And he'll do it a little bit with religion, but not so much with politics. And this is after I've logged a lot of hours talking to him, that for not buying into this, it's cynicism. And that's a very, very common view of people who are that age. And this obviously plays in the mainstream media, how much the term conspiracy theory is used as a term of complete dismissal, because that's who's watching that media. That term means something to them, that it's, you know, tinfoil hats, Area 51, aliens, Elvis, everything gets filed in the same cabinet. So that's one of the things that I think is different about how people of the next generation are examining what's going on around them in the world. And I think that's important because the mainstream media being consumed by baby boomers who have, by and large, this innocence about a lot of these topics are being told to dismiss any alternative theories. And I mean, even I'm old enough to remember the world without the internet. This new frontier is vastly untrustworthy. Right. And that's where all of these theories and all of this paranoia is being propagated. So my point is that we're kind of in a transition out of that really being the predominant thinking, at least in this country, through things like CNN, Fox News, MSNBC. All of that stuff is just shuffled off to the side by people who are all too willing to dismiss it, because I think they're used to, by and large, sweeping under the carpet things that are uncomfortable, just like you're not too different from your two housewives example from a few moments ago. But I see that innocence as the result of a off-limitsness about many, many things.
Yeah. There's so many things that in what you just said that need to be unpacked. The baby boomers as a generation were born in the 50s. Well, they came of age in the 70s. Now, we've come of age with the internet, but you think about the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, right? The Summer of Love. Suddenly, you didn't just have to do what your father did. In Australia, education, tertiary education was free. And there was this massive push for people in the 70s to go to uni. And you could go to university, then go overseas on a big surfing tour, come back, and there'd be a job waiting for you. But mass media really became a thing. That time difference between when a song was released in the United States and when it was released in Australia was narrowing. But at the same time, Walter Cronkite was the father figure for families every night at 6 on the news. Vietnam, that sort of pyrrhic victory of fighting the system with Vietnam, Daniel Ellsberg, Watergate. There's this whole cadre of things that occurred that shape the collective conscious, to use Durkheimian language, not Jungian collective subconscious or unconscious, but the zeitgeist, the collective understanding of the world, with a definite sense of fair and a definite sense of right and wrong, which maybe ties back into your use of the word innocence, which I'm not entirely comfortable with, but I see what you're sort of saying there.
Mm-hmm.
Naivety maybe would be a better word. In some ways.
Which is actually in that same conversation, just to add this in, that I had with my father, he used that word to describe himself. And he actually kind of backpedaled from "you're a cynic" to, "well, now I understand from my perspective, and I'm very naive, you know, that my view of you is cynical for asking these questions or not believing the system." So naive resonates with me in this case. Yeah.
when's the last time you were talking to someone and you said something and they kind of gave you a funny look and asked, Brett, did you read that on the internet?
Well, sometimes it's, I've learned to spot that look without having to be asked the follow-up question. And some people are very polite, you know, and that's why, you know, I talked a lot about, you know, having these conversations with family members or friends of family throughout the years on School Sucks in the past. And I always appreciated, my mother's partner and a man I've referred to as my crazy liberal uncle, who don't do that polite nod and then eye roll. They say, hey, you're fucking nuts. How can you think that? And they'll engage you. And whether they really want to know why you think that or not, they're at least opening up a conversation to take place, even if it's fairly hostile. And, you know, from my experience, unproductive. Right. So you can at least, there's at least a feedback system going on while other people are so uncomfortable with some of these topics, talking about why do you vote, paying taxes. Other people just kind of suffered in silence and listened to me like with their muscles tensed, but never really said, did you read that on the internet? But probably in their minds filed me into this category of, oh, he's one of those people, those internet reading people.
But it's just, I mean, you're laughing because to say internet reading people has become just a nothing term. And this is what I think we're talking a little bit across terms, but what am I, 6 years younger than you?
You're 28?
Yeah.
10 years younger than me.
Okay. So we were probably at different maturity levels when the internet became popular. What was it, 95 or 96, we were in the primary school or elementary school library asking if we could look up a website that I cut out of a cereal box, to today where everyone's looking at Facebook apps on their phone. So there was a period there where the distrust of the internet was very, very high. And even today, there are still some people who hold out and won't buy things online because they're worried, like they won't do internet banking.
Right.
They'll still go into the tower with their little book and write, you know, the figures on one side of the ledger and the balance on the other. But by and large, if we get back to this concept of the collective conscious, the internet has become foundational to what we do in everyday life. So to say to someone, did you read that on the internet, is like saying, did you read that in a book?
You're right.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. It just doesn't hold the same weight anymore. And I think this gets back to, I mean, we've been talking for, what, an hour and a half, and we haven't even got into the second question or my findings. We're still on the first question of defining conspiracy theory.
That's why these shows end with a thon.
Because it's so nebulous, though. That's what we're finding. Like, we haven't been able to sit down and just go, okay, do you agree that conspiracy theory means the illegal acts of two people to produce a benefit for themselves at the cost of other people, of their victims, right? I mean, we could pull out Black's Law Dictionary and get a definition, but it's meaningless because it's not what people associate it with. And that's where that documentary, The Conspiracy Theory Conspiracy, is so meaningful. But also what I was getting at before, in the sense of it's a space. There's also this element of the power of conspiracy theories comes from what Benjamin emphasizes, which is a craving of a kind of belief, a craving for the belief in the Illuminati, or a craving for the belief in the 1,000-year reign of Christ.
Hell yes. You know? Absolutely. Oh my goodness. Craving for the belief that the Apollo missions were fake and filmed on a soundstage by Stanley Kubrick. One of the strongest cravings in my life.
Well, you know what's weird? My dad passed away this year, but when he was alive, when we were growing up, he used to tell me that Nixon had ordered Kubrick to film it when he was doing 2001, just in case. And it was always going to be like backup. I have looked for 2 years pretty hard to find some kind of corroboration of that anywhere. Where did my dad come up with that Nixon hired Kubrick to do it? But it makes sense, doesn't it? Because what if they died? Did you study math at all, Brett?
Math?
Maths, mathematics.
Yes, I taught math in high school for 2 years, yeah.
Right. Okay, so you taught it. So you know that it's very easy to do a whole lot of workings out, come to an answer, and then go, shit, I think I got a plus where I should have had a minus.
Yep, sure. In any multi-step problem, that is a possibility.
So how many steps does it take to send a rocket to the goddamn moon?
More than any math problem I've ever tackled in my life, for sure.
Right. So what is the chance of error? You
know, oh, the chance of, yeah.
What if they got it wrong? What if the material didn't hold up? What if the insulation wasn't right and they froze to death when they left the atmosphere? What if the radiation belt was real? What if there was some kind of technical fault like in Apollo 13? Are you really going to broadcast on international live television three dead bodies floating in some... Do you know what I mean?
Well, that's, like, yeah, I mean, that's the interesting thing about it, because almost everything about the Apollo 11 mission is testable outside of the lander. And that's like the real money shot of that broadcast, right? The part where they fucking land on the moon. So you could send a living thing into space to see about radiation. You could do multiple test launches, and they did. And they had accidents, and people died. People were burned to death. But
Capricorn's the movie, but Capricorn 1's an interesting film that sort of tackles the same ideas. I have no doubt that man has been to the moon. No doubt at all. And there's a whole section in my thesis that deals with the moon landing. But I think it's just crazy to think that it happened. Just, this is it. We're going to do it. I mean, it's possible. It's possible that Apollo 11 happened exactly as they said. But it's also possible that it didn't.
Now, you say you have no doubt.
Well, of course not.
Okay. Bookmark right there. We'll come back to that.
I wouldn't be surprised if there's been endeavors to Mars already.
Oh, shit. Well, that's new territory as well.
If they did it and it was a newspaper report and there was no, or it was radio and there was no TV, then it's the jeopardy levels are different. But when you consider the scale, I think all the infrastructure was built around it. But and the thing that gets me is that people go, there's more computer power in your mobile phone than what was used to send man to the moon. And I'm like, fucking really? Because I've never accidentally opened the Send Neil Armstrong to the Moon app and fired him off.
Well, I just think that they're talking about in processor speed.
It's totally bad counting, because it's not processor speed that sent man to the moon. It's networking. And also, you're talking about how many very smart people were in, what's it called, Brett, where they launched the rocket from?
Cape Canaveral.
Cape Canaveral. How many very intelligent people were there?
Oh, I would say some top men.
So you're talking processing power, but you're also talking many, many years of experience on how to use that. That I think the gestalt of that is far beyond any smartphone.
Well, I think the fertile soil in which the best conspiracies grow is a kind of mass ignorance about certain things. So, like I've said,
it's
in these
the
kinds of
opaque space where we're unable to easily tangibly understand. Right?
Yeah. Well, I've said this too about conspiracy theories and an attempt to prove them and an attempt to debunk them. People trying to do either task drag laymen into very difficult to understand areas. So with 9/11. Yeah, nanothermite, physics, JFK, ballistics. This moon landing one is like the most fertile soil of all, because no one standing on Earth, even, 46 years later, almost no one understands how that was done. Not because it was physically or technically impossible to do. That's just like a very, very specific set of knowledge. I want to believe it's fake, but I don't have enough information to say with any credibility or with any conviction that I believe it. I just think it would be cool if Stanley Kubrick did it. And there was all kinds of motives for them to fake it. It was the perfect time to fake it. The country was about to basically explode and burn apart. Yeah, a great stage is set for that. But can I prove that? Absolutely not. I just love that theory.
And it's also dealing with emergence theory as well. So that's difficult to, in some ways.
Can you just explain that too?
So emergence theory, I'm not overly familiar with it, but the idea is that you have a series of non-related but connected phenomena that produce something totally different. So you're talking about a mathematical process of the science and physics of sending man to the moon. That's one phenomena. You're talking about a political process at the federal level, which is another phenomena. You're talking about a willingness of a general public to believe in the power. Like, they weren't incredulous. It wasn't like when it happened, people were like, ah, bullshit. Never happened. Like, people were in schools cheering. You know, like, they had assemblies where they rolled a black and white TV into the middle of the amphitheater and showed it. And
right.
These are all separate but connected phenomena. And then the emergence of that is the belief that Neil Armstrong was the first man to walk on the moon.
Okay.
Now, when I say belief there, I'm not saying that it's only a belief, but I'm saying, like, no one has on their own verified that it happened that way. And that's, I think, where you're coming from. You can't. But my counter argument to that is electricity. I don't understand electricity. I don't understand the processes that are involved for me to press a switch and to have illumination in my room. But I don't come up with some wild conspiracy theory that Quentin Tarantino staged it all.
I love that theory too.
There's something else. There's an extra element in sending man to the moon. Another perfect example. How many of us understand the physics of plane flight?
I mean, I understand the basics, but I've talked before on this show, and I talk about it publicly, and I talk about it with whoever happens to be next to me when a plane flies overhead, how amazing I think that is. And I will stop and watch almost. I mean, I live right underneath one of the main inbound paths for the Manchester airport. So I can sit on my deck and watch low planes fly right by. And I almost want to cheer when it happens. It's amazing to me. I get the basic physics of it, but the answer to your question is not me. When it really comes down to it.
So I think what is unique about the moon landing is that it only really happened in that window. Like, it's not happening frequently, right? So even if you and I never went to the moon, but there was like some Titanic like cruise ship that sailed from Cape Canaveral to Fort Moonland on a regular basis,
mm-hmm.
It would just be insane to suggest that someone staged the first moon landing. Even if they had, it just would hold no water whatsoever because it's such a mundane task. And in a similar way, to suggest that the Wright brothers never flew the biplane is just like, what are you talking about? Like, even if they didn't, who cares? I can go to Melbourne Airport, jump on a plane, 24, 48 hours later, I'll be at Manchester Airport, you know, short cab ride, I'll be sipping Coronas with Brett on his deck. Like, who gives a shit about the Wright brothers? But
yep.
It's that element of the space in between that makes the moon. And it's that, again, we get back to that emergent factor. So what is it that makes it such a powerful craving for you is not physics, is not the victory, but the political atmosphere when it happened.
Exactly.
And so that's a very different question. And that's a very fruitful question, because now we can start to pick this one apart. And now we can start to deconstruct it and say, well, why are you interested, Brett, in the political atmosphere of 1969? What is so special about that moment that would lead you to want to believe a massive hoax such as the moon landing took place? And again, I'm not saying that it was a hoax. I'm just saying it is a reasonable assumption to think that if you're making, and the amount of money that would have been spent to bring that project to fruition, wouldn't you have a contingency plan in place? Even if we take it on a scale model, right, and you go to a bank and say, Mr. Bank Manager, I need money to do this amazing project. They say, this is great. We're almost ready to sign the line. We just need your contingency plans. In any scenario, and I think you could draw a very clear parallel between the way that the moon landing was organized and a massive military operation in the sense of mobilizing manpower to produce the desired outcome, there are contingency plans at every single step of the way, right? Now, to say that Kubrick was this mastermind who, like Jay Widener says, with all the different aspects of intrigue about Kubrick as a cult of personality, yeah, it draws you in. And it's a great space for asking the what-if question. But there's the banality of the reality of that event, Apollo 11, and then there's the intrigue, and they don't necessarily communicate on the same line or the same level.
Why use the word I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just curious. Why use the word banality? Moon landings are not airplane flights, right? I mean, moon landings occurred between 1969 and I want to say 1972. In terms of all technological achievements, it's relatively rare and extraordinary.
Absolutely. The outcome of it is. But the process leading to that outcome isn't.
Okay.
And that's where the banality comes. It would have just been hours and hours and hours of grueling, tedious work where people are sat at their desk with slide rules, working out the physics of modules, supervisors who were connecting modules in a very bureaucratic way. So the actual function of people involved in it, I think, could be. I'm just saying, what if we think of it this way? You know, I think in the brief I sent you, there was this idea of a video I saw years ago, and it was one of those like really absurd moments. I might have watched it at 3 a.m. or something. I didn't know what I was watching. A slideshow, these two people, a man and a woman, presenting a slideshow in like an art theater with a wooden floor and wooden chairs. And they had a picture of the Earth. And they go, why do you think the Earth is round? What if the Earth isn't round, but the camera lens and the window through which the camera lens was aimed is what makes it appear round? Now, let's be very clear here. I am not suggesting, because we got satellite photos, we got basic mathematical functions that are used every day by ships. I'm definitely not advocating flat Earth theory here. But damn, it's an interesting question, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
To say, what if why we think the Earth is round is because of something out of left field that we didn't initially expect, like the shape of a window on the spaceship that took the photo.
Right.
And it's very easy to get drawn down one path as just a flat-out rejection of another path without necessarily coming back from that path and actually observing the landscape.
So dichotomies like, well, I don't believe you, so I'm going with this. You know what I mean? Like the evolution versus creation debate. You're with us or you're with the terrorists.
You're either a cultural Marxist or Hitler was a great guy.
I haven't heard that one, but I getcha. People buy into some conspiracy theory, and then they're countered by people who believe the official story, as if those are the only two choices, their theory or this official story, which is kind of a term that conspiracy theorists use as a pejorative, that it's not the real story, it's just what the authorities say. So that's kind of built into the term official story. So when they say, okay, well, I reject that, like I did, not when I heard about 9/11, but when I started to look into 9/11 years later, and I said, well, this doesn't really seem like it has a tremendous amount of depth after even reading into it a little bit. And I don't believe you people, and your story doesn't make any sense, so I only have this other path to go down here. Now, I could have been right in that case, but I'm saying that that's the dichotomy that people are often faced with, and they never do what you're talking about. It's like go down this tunnel or go down this tunnel, but never really look at it from the top. And I mean, yeah. So this kind of brings up the trivium, but yep. Go ahead.
Well, I just think like the other great analogy we use is the rabbit hole, you know, fall down a rabbit hole, but no one ever talks about the Warren, you know, that place where all the rabbit holes intersect. And this is getting back to what I said about living inside story. We can never actually get outside of story. So even if we can recognize and dismiss some facts, the actual self, the ego that has interacted with the world can dismiss a fact, but it can't dismiss the identity of self in that sense. So to break out a story and to recognize alternative discourse is a very laborious task.
Describe that process, breaking out of story.
Okay, you were raised Catholic.
Yeah.
Let's say that you didn't ever pick up a course in miracles and break out of the dogma of the Catholic Church, and then you met a beautiful Muslim woman,
mm-hmm.
and you fell head over heels in love, and you would do anything for her, and years go by, and you've built this really strong connection, relationship, and you go to her father and say, I would like to marry your daughter. Dowry, please. And that was a joke, by the way. I know you wouldn't ask for dairy. And he says, Brett, we would love to have you as a part of our family. You're a wonderful man. Your school sucks. Project is awesome. But I cannot give you my permission. And you say, why? Why are you going to be so rude? I'm going to marry that girl. Marry her anyway. And he says, yes, Brett, I appreciate that. But you need to become a Muslim if you want to marry our daughter. And you say, well, yeah, fuck it. I'm not that big a Catholic. Sign me up. That process between shifting from Catholicism to Islam is going to challenge you in ways that you don't even understand, because there are basic assumptions that you operate on that will be challenged. Like when you drive a car, you do things at an automated level. So you might have an experience where you drive home, get home and go, where the fuck was I mentally for the last half hour? Mm-hmm. I don't remember anything, because it's all automated processes. To undo those processes and to realign them to get to other processes is very difficult. So to go from being a Catholic to a Muslim will challenge those. But even if we just take the car analogy, it might be a bit simpler even. To say, I've been driving to work this one way my whole life. It works. It's glorious. It's beautiful. And someone says, Brett, come on. You know that you got to go the other way. You look into it and go, all right, yeah, I can see that the way I've been driving to work every day was a bit wrong. You know, stuck in traffic, this, that, and the other. I could actually go a different route and get there a lot more efficiently. I'm going to start going the other route. The actual method you use to drive that other route has not changed. And that's what I'm talking about here. We live inside story, and we're just altering the way that we tell the story, the words we use, without altering the actual cognitive pathways, synaptic highways in our brains that produce our knowledge and thoughts.
So a real world example, I spend a lot of time at home because I work at home and I live at home. So I'm home a lot.
I assume that you live at home if you're calling the place home.
And it works out perfectly in that respect.
Yeah.
When I go out and I go to a lot of the same places, I almost always try. I live in a city that's kind of like a grid. So now anybody can do this regardless of where they live, where they're going, but it's kind of easy and convenient for me to do it. I can literally go a slightly different route anytime I go somewhere and anytime I come back home. And I try to do that because I like to see, you know, explore and see different parts of the city that I live in. What you're saying is that if I really wanted significant change, because that's change for me, that's new scenery for me. But if tomorrow, instead of just going a slightly different route using the same methods and same practices, if I went on, say, a pogo stick, I would actually be getting a new experience when I just choose different routes using the same method of going to point A, from point A to point B. I'm not doing that.
And imagine what would actually change in you if, let's take it as a thought experiment. So tomorrow, do you have to go anywhere tomorrow?
Sure, yeah.
Where do you have to go?
I have to go to the supermarket.
Okay, remember, shop the perimeter. That's your...
That's it. Yeah. Shop the perimeter.
Just a super fan here. don't mind me. When you go to the supermarket, you normally get in your car, drive, find a park, right? It takes, what, 20 minutes to drive there?
Yeah, sure. That all sounds about right. That's pretty much the process.
Yeah. If you were to go tomorrow, and let's imagine that you're actually going to do this now, on pogo stick. Okay, first challenge, pogo stick. Where are you going to get a pogo stick before tomorrow?
Where do you get a pogo stick in 2015? I don't know. That's going to be very difficult.
Let's say you could. eBay Express Freight.
Yep. Okay. So we've added the pogo stick.
You're waiting around, and that's fine. You work at home, so you can have a flexible schedule. Pogo stick arrives. Next challenge. I don't know what type of shop you do. Do you do like a weekly shop, or do you do like, you know, incremental, like you'll just do two dinners when you go to the supermarket?
I usually base it around eggs. So I eat 2 eggs a day, and they come in cartons of 12. So I go to the supermarket about every 6 days. I usually shop for the duration of a carton of eggs.
Okay. May I suggest buying chickens?
Now, that would change things up a lot.
Well, I own chickens.
Mm-hmm.
You learn a lot about birds when you own chickens. Those things eat. So, but the eggs, well and truly worth it. But now you've got another challenge. Where do you get bird feed? you know.
Exactly.
But anyway, so getting back to the egg situation. So we're talking 6 days of shopping. It's probably $125, $150 worth of groceries, let's say. Yeah?
$120, yeah.
$120 worth of groceries. Conservative estimate, 8 to 10 bags full of groceries.
Oh, shit. I forgot about that. Yeah, yeah, all right. So, yeah, this is getting complicated.
Okay, so pogo stick. You're going to need some kind of, like, backpacker's European adventure contraption on your back to carry all those groceries. Or you're going to need to revamp your schedule and not get 6 days worth of food and just a reasonable backpack worth.
Mm-hmm.
When's the last time you rode a pogo stick?
Probably 1987, 1988.
So 30 years ago, roughly.
Yeah, so I've got the way there to practice before I'm going to have to come home with the eggs, right?
Right. But now what about, like, how do you stop on a pogo stick? Because I'm assuming it's not, like, dirt roads that you can just go directly to. I'm assuming there's intersections. You talked about a grid. There's probably a lot of pedestrians there.
Yep.
Right.
You can stop your forward momentum pretty easily. When you jump, you can kind of tilt back a little bit, so you're coming in at an angle, so you won't pogo forward so much. And you do that a couple times, and you can pretty much just be pogoing in place shortly after.
As a man, I'm a little bit concerned about this pogo stick situation, though, because if you overcorrect.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically a giant T in your hand with your legs straddled on either side.
Mm-hmm.
So you see where I'm going with that.
I've been where you're going with that as a lad. Yeah, pogo stick injuries.
I think that would ruin your day.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But then you're going to have the interaction of people stopping you or looking at you, or you're going to meet people. Maybe not the first trip, but there'll be like yik yaks about this pogo stick guy in New Hampshire. You know, it will fundamentally change a part of who you are, a part of how you identify yourself, in that it's so far from conformity to be pogo sticking to the supermarket.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to walk around the supermarket holding a I assume you're not going to try and pogo while you shop the perimeter.
It would be impractical, because every time that I wanted to pick something up, unless I developed a system for this, I would pretty much have to get off the pogo stick, because you can't come to a stop on a pogo stick.
Well, what would management say if you're pogoing around the store?
I bet someone would talk to me about doing that, about the danger that it poses, not just to me, but to other people in the store. Going around corners, especially on a Sunday. I mean, unfortunately, you know, every sixth day fell. This time it falls on a Sunday, and it's going to be one of the busiest days. And on the weekends when the supermarket is busy, here in America, a lot of people are really overweight, and they prefer the little Mario Kart scooters.
Yeah,
for their supermarket trips, so it could be really treacherous.
The rascals.
Really treacherous with all those rascals in the aisles.
And that's just like a what if, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming that you're not actually going to go and get a pogo stick. But we can see, just in that scenario, how many things have changed for you in your thought process. Even if you just did something much more mundane, like walked or caught a bus.
Mm-hmm.
Or ask someone to drive you there. There are so many different ways we can look at it. It's not just which way do you drive to the supermarket and back, right?
Yeah.
And I think in terms of our analogy, that's a lot of what's happening with the way that conspiracy narratives discussed metacognitively. And that's why I adopted conspiracy narratives in my thesis as opposed to conspiracy theory, because I think it opens it up a little bit more and avoids that immediate connotation.
Yeah, and I think that it's worth pointing out to the opportunity for expanding even critical thinking, even though, well, I mean, it depends, because the problem with accepting what you're told by, say, the government or the pharmaceutical industry or anything that is anti-conspiracy theory, the mainstream media, versus the enriching exploratory experience you can have investigating something that is an alternative theory, well, that's worth pointing out. But then you have this other problem where a lot of these people don't wind up in these places because they're better critical thinkers, or they're more curious, or they're more independent, and they wind up buying into everything. somebody like Alex Jones says.
In the exact same way, I bet it happens to you that there are people who like Bert Van Aert and accept whatever you say without necessarily appreciating the content of your work.
Interesting.
It's like going into a movie knowing you're already going to like it. And then whatever the movie throws up, you come out going, that was a great movie. The Broccoli's made it, so it's good.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Instead of not knowing anything about the movie, going in, coming out and thinking, what have I just seen?
I just had this experience where we went to see Straight Outta Compton, the movie about NWA. And this was a big part of my teenage years. So, you know, I'm driving to the theater going, I'm going to love this movie. I'm going to love this movie. I'm going to love this movie. And I went and I saw it with the podcast masters, Gardner and Osborne. And we all, the movie ended. The ending was awesome. We all stood up and said, did you love that movie? And we said, yeah, I love that movie. And then we went home and talked for 2.5 hours pretty much about how we love the movie. And even engaged because we were so excited about what we had just seen in a kind of hero worship of NWA. Mm-hmm. But then I had an entirely different conversation last night with Thaddeus Russell about the same movie after having a few days to reflect on it. So yes, I think there, and I appreciate whenever this rule is broken, there are probably people who would say, yeah, I just like whatever you do because I like you.
You just, if you're really honest with yourself, there'll be times when your friends, the people you love, your family cause you to question. And at that point, you have a moment where you can sort of break out of that storyline and start a new storyline. But we didn't even get close to talking about my findings, so I think we're going to have to do a part two, Brett.
I want the next show to be this other question that you asked your interviewees.
Oh, can we do a teaser?
Yep.
So, Steve.
All right.
What would it change in your life if you were to assume that all the conspiracy theories were true?
Wow.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please help us out by leaving a positive review on iTunes. If you were angered by the show, please help us out by leaving negative reviews everywhere. If you think this is an important message for students, for parents, or for the future of intellectual freedom, please consider supporting us. SchoolSucksProject.com/AV. For $6 a month, you'll get access to hundreds of additional hours of content while helping us grow and spread this message further.